Everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. It is still October. It is still scary movie month at F This Movie. So I'm with the scariest guy I know, JB.
Hello. Man, do I like October.
Me too. We're going to be talking about the new horror anthology movie VHS.
And some other stuff
on this episode. But as always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. If you like our show, go to the iTunes store and leave us a positive review. It helps other people find our show. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. But let's talk about the important thing, which is the Scary Movie Challenge number 3. The third year we've been doing this, this is obviously the most successful and popular Scary Movie Challenge we've done yet. Many, many, many entries thanks to all of you who are participating, whether you do one, whether you do 50. It's all great. It's so much fun to read what everybody's watching and know that everybody's spending October doing what we all love to do, watching horror movies.
And so, some of the postings have been very, very entertaining.
Oh, I mean, I love reading all of them, even when it's just a straight review. Some people have gotten very clever. I feel like this year's crop of 7-word reviews, which I guess I should explain what it is. This year's crop has been better than in the past, I feel like. If you don't already know what it is, the Scary Movie Challenge is, anytime you watch a horror movie in October, go to fthismovie.net, find the Scary Movie Challenge post, and leave a 7-word review.
This year we also have a much bigger group of people who can accurately count to 7.
So we're going to read some of our favorites, as we love to do, JB.
Steve K., who's emerging as one of my favorites, is working his way through the Universal Mummy series and arrived at The Mummy's Hand from 1940. And his 7-word review is, a better title, Where's the Damn Mummy? Because early on, Universal relegates those to B movie status and starts using footage from the previous ones. It really gets out of hand.
Well, that's always been actually my complaint with the original Boris Karloff mummy. Where's the mummy? There's not a lot of the mummy. We did a show recently on the Universal Monsters. Go ahead and listen to it. We didn't spend that much time talking about the mummy, but the mummy is one of my less favorites.
Well, because he spends most of the film as Imhotep.
Exactly.
And you get that amazing sequence at the beginning, which is the only scene they show when that film is talked about. And the problem was, apparently the makeup took 9 hours. So how many days?
Sure.
And Bramwell Fletcher is a big part of what makes that scene so great, because who shouts like Bramwell Fletcher? He went for a little walk.
I'm going to lead off with my favorite of all the entries so far.
Wow.
Because perhaps you have it as well. And
I bet I do.
I want to beat you to it. Adam writes, Friday the 13th, Part 3, which is a movie we just recorded a commentary for. If you haven't already listened to it, you should. It's a lot of fun. National Film Registry, Balls in Your Court. That's my favorite of all of them.
I think there's something wrong with my laptop.
Some aren't
showing. Last week and today, you're reading reviews I haven't seen.
Well, there's a bunch, so it's easy to accidentally skip some as well.
My next one is from Michael Kidd, one of our listeners, not the famous choreographer who recently passed away. Hellraiser. I absolutely will not come to daddy.
Here's a similar one from Corbin Foster, also from Hellraiser. Anatomy Man likes to be called daddy. Everybody's picking up on the same weird little aspect of Hellraiser.
It's true. My next one is from Heath Holland, and God, we love Heath. He's reviewing the original 1922 Nosferatu. This made me laugh out loud the first time I read it, and then going through them to find these for tonight. It made me laugh out loud all over again. Heath is reviewing the 1922 Nosferatu, and his review is, German silent documentary of a young Ross Perot.
Michael Carey writes of Alice, Sweet Alice, creepy girl wearing creepy mask is creepy. And I liked that one because of seven words, three of them are the same.
And that creepy girl recently passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Clint J. reviews Human Centipede, first sequence, and his seven-word review is, yet another reason not to visit Germany.
Jessica writes of Session 9, asbestos removal will make you fucking crazy.
Stuart reviews the original Creepshow and says, that old guy sure does love cake.
Yeah, that was a good one. I like that one. Mac McIntyre says, Friday the 13th, the original. How much for the Monopoly product placement? Which I'll ask because I had just watched Friday the 13th. And yeah, there's a weird scene where they're all playing Monopoly.
And it's very strange because months and months ago, that was one of the original Shitting on the Classics.
Last October,
columns.
Yeah.
And I believe that's a paragraph that hit the curb because I'm like, crazy teenagers off on their own, off on a Monopoly tear. Whose idea of youth is this? And finally, one of our own, Mike Pomero, writes of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Am I the only one that likes this? No, Mike, you're not. I love that movie.
Really?
I love it.
Okay.
I have come around. I'm aware of the quibbles.
Yeah.
And it did start a dangerous, well, we won't get into it, but
it started. It was part of it.
Yeah.
Which I was excited about in the early 90s. I thought, oh my gosh, they're rebooting all the classic monsters. We have Brenna doing Frankenstein and Mike Nichols doing the Wolfman and Stephen Frears doing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
There's
all
a lot,
with mixed results.
There's a lot to like in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I would agree with that.
And it took me a really long time to come around. I think there's far more to love than there is to quibble.
I would agree with that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some sort of amazing things
it's
going
the work
on
of a madman, which you have to appreciate.
And for the longest time in class, I used it as an example of where we had come to, because in the original Dracula, Dracula is an agent of Satan, and Van Helsing is the man of science, and if we follow the man of science, we will triumph. And in the work of a madman, we now have the agent of Satan as our romantic hero, and the man of science, completely crazy and out of his mind. Welcome to the 90s.
But I would say that's even true in 2012. I think that movie is prescient in a lot of the ways that it predicts Twilight, and it predicts our national hatred of science.
He's not killing, he's loving.
Jay Bones, have you seen anything scary lately?
Yes, in my pathetic attempt with this pesky thing I call a full-time job.
Oh, come on.
To keep up with the scary movie challenge, I finally sat down and watched Blood of Dracula, which I had never seen, which is strange because I've owned the action figure for a really long time. Someone was selling it cheap at Wonderfest, and I couldn't resist.
Are there any other action figure? I'm looking around right now. JB has the entire history of horror reproduced in action figure form in his basement in chronological order. Are there other action figures that you own for movies which you have not seen?
That is the only one.
Wow.
That is clearly the only one.
Yeah.
And I used to do a count of them, and I wish I could come up just off the top of my head with a count, but let's just say there's several. Someone at Wonderfest was selling it cheap. It was not mint in box. I couldn't resist. It's sort of an iconic figure of a busty 50s babe with great gams, and she is just the most hideous makeup on, so it's the ultimate butterface. I never put that together. And watching it, I realized that it's of a piece with Roger Corman's earlier I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, and to a lesser extent How to Make a Monster, that it's clearly using that template, and it should have been called I Was a Teenage Vampire, because it's about this difficult girl who's put in a boarding school by her father, and she doesn't adapt well to the peer pressure, and a bull goose loony biology teacher hypnotizes her and turns her into a vampire. And it's not
the same way that he was turned into a werewolf in Teenage Werewolf, hypnosis.
Oh, no. I mean, it's like, Xerox the script and change the names, and this made money, and so will this. Some people really love it for the makeup and the iconic monster, maybe because it's just part of that series. But I couldn't believe how bad it was. Although it's got great 50s dialogue, and you know you're in bad territory where about halfway through the film stops for a musical number from someone who obviously someone was pushing to be a teen idol, never happened. Yeah, so that's
movie
why.
In the 50s.
And the song is called Puppy Love, and it's...
It's not "and they call it Puppy Love."
No, it's... Okay. No, it's the other Puppy Love, the one that no one sings. It's awful. I had a lot of fun watching it.
Yeah. Do you, in October, when you're trying to watch all these scary movies, do you ever sort of deliberately watch something that you know? We were just talking about this before we pressed record, that as horror movie fans, we still enjoy movies that we know to be bad. I went through and watched several of the Friday the 13th movies. I don't think any of them are very good, but it's October and I want to watch horror movies. And so I try and balance out stuff I really like, stuff I've never seen, stuff that I'll call comfort food, you know, like... I when I eat pizza, I like to eat good pizza, but sometimes I'll eat the Dirtball Pizza Hut, too, because I like it. So I'll watch a Friday the 13th movie. Do you ever sit down and watch something that you know isn't very good?
No.
No, okay.
I only have a few years left, so I'm trying to make the most of it. The closest I came to that is watching Phantom of the Opera for the Universal box. And
yeah.
But that was sort of my duty.
But
no,
it looked
I'm
so
looking,
great.
I'm
it really did. I mean, it's a great transfer.
I skipped around and I went right to the unmasking scene and sort of just watched that again, or maybe listen to Claude Rains' voice, because Claude Rains' voice is delightful. What have you seen lately?
Oh, well, I saw two movies that actually tie right into the movie that we're talking about tonight. I saw two horror movies, one directed by Ty West, who is sort of one of the new leaders of sort of the modern horror movement, because he made House of the Devil, and he made The Innkeepers, which is a movie I love this year, one of my favorite movies of the year. His first movie is a movie called The Roost, about some teenagers who stumble upon a barn where there are sort of these vampire bats that turn people into bloodthirsty zombies. It has a lot of the problems of a lot of Ty West movies, with few of the benefits. He's sort of known for his glacial pacing.
You had mentioned that on your 7-word review.
And this movie suffers from that. And I perked up a little bit at the beginning because he does that thing where it's introduced sort of as a creature feature where you have Tom Noonan as the host of a fictional black and white sort of Svengoolie-esque show.
That got my attention.
Introducing this movie, and I thought, oh, this is Ty West doing something different. But The Roost suffers from so many of the same problems. And I say that as a guy who kind of likes, you know, Ty West. I like House of the Devil a lot, and I really like The Innkeepers. The other movie I saw was directed by... Oh, anyway, and I mentioned that because Ty West directed a segment in VHS.
Which you're going to have to inform me of, because the end credits went by, and I was trying to identify things, but I was unsuccessful.
The other movie I saw was a movie called A Horrible Way to Die, directed by a guy named Adam Wingard, I want to say, who also directed a segment in VHS.
That name sounds familiar.
And A Horrible Way to Die is problematic. It's about I won't get too much into what it's about. A girl breaks up with her boyfriend after finding out he's a serial killer. She sends him to prison. He gets out and tries to find her again as she tries to pick up the pieces. And it's told very much out of order. So what I just gave you is a very linear version of this movie, which it is not. It's not the worst movie. The performances are okay. It has a few interesting ideas. But it's one of these movies that you watch that is incredibly frustrating because the director can't get out of his own way. It is wall-to-wall this obnoxious style, this self-conscious sort of handheld, all these different, I won't even say they're lens flares. It's wall-to-wall style that calls attention to itself as being style, and it gets in the way of the movie.
This sounds like you're talking about the main feature we're going to discuss tonight.
It's available on Netflix Instant if you're interested in seeing it. I don't recommend it, but check it out for yourself. Adam Wingard has recently made a movie called You're Next, which hasn't come out yet, but has played a few fests, and a lot of the critics, the online guys who have seen it, swear that this movie's going to be huge. I believe Lionsgate picked it up. I think it comes out next year.
Does it have anything to do with Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
No.
Okay.
It's supposed to be great. So again, I'm pulling for this guy if he's the next big thing, but A Horrible Way to Die, I did not like.
So should we use Ty West as our inroad into VHS?
Sure.
VHS is a horror anthology that, like many horror anthologies, is held together with a frame story. Although this one played a trick with the frame story at the end, which I want to discuss a little bit later. Which segment did Ty West direct?
Ty West did a segment called Second Honeymoon.
Okay.
So real quick, VHS is available on demand right now if you're able to see it. It's also playing in very limited theatrical release.
I saw it on demand. I wondered, is it available on VHS?
I don't believe it is.
Because I think one thing that would actually add to your experience watching it home on demand, I think even before the studio logo, we hear a VHS, that very distinctive sound of the VHS tape being fed into the machine, which would have to be lost in the theater. That would just be demented in a theater.
Yeah. We're going to talk about it spoiler-free for a little while, and then I think...
Oh, are we?
Yeah, okay. I mean, a little bit, I think. And then we'll get into spoilers.
I'm kind of joking.
I don't know. I think it's worth checking out before we even get into it. I think it's worth seeing.
I would kind of disagree with that.
Okay.
I only watched it 2 hours ago.
Right.
So please understand, these are fresh opinions that just fell out of my head.
Okay.
Like the work of Paul Thomas Anderson, perhaps I need some time
perhaps
to think about this and to let my opinion steep like a fine glass of tea.
Well, and part of the reason I think it's worth checking out is because it is an anthology, which we'll kind of talk about later, and they don't make too many of those.
And there's a reason they don't make too many of
those. That's true. And also because it does represent all these sort of new voices in horror, and I don't think they're all successful. In fact, I think about one and a half of them are successful.
Okay, because I want to hear about this, because one of my complaints about the film is I am old. And after a while, the handheld found footage conceit gets very hard to watch. It's just so the same. And I understand the conceit of this is that it's all found footage. And I actually appreciate the fact that in some sequences, the characters had a better camcorder than in other sequences. There's one segment that's clearly meant to be Skype or something.
Which... it doesn't make any sense that a Skype conversation would be on a VHS tape found in an old man's house. But whatever.
This old man reaches far and wide for the finest things to watch in his creepy room with many monitors.
Suspend our disbelief.
Suspend our disbelief.
A few weeks ago, we did a podcast, I think, on Side by Side, and I had just seen VHS, and I believe I introduced it by saying it combines something I really like, which is the horror anthology, with something I really hate, which is the found footage horror movie. I think in some cases, the aesthetic helps, I think, trying to recreate sort of the look of a weird, crummy VHS helps. In fact, in one segment, I would argue the worst segment in the movie, it's the only thing that it has going for it. It's a segment called Tuesday the 17th, directed by Glenn McQuaid, who directed a movie called I Sell the Dead, which I have not yet seen.
But you're going to have to give me more than the title because I'm trying to remember what that might
refer to. Well, the
to.
Title itself is a little bit of an indication as to which segment that is. Kids go into the woods, a girl has a vendetta against a serial killer.
And you're saying that the saving grace of that sequence
is the thing that it does with the format, which is that the killer
cannot be videotaped.
Cannot be videotaped.
In a standard sense
of
the word.
And it's a weird sort of tracking thing. And it's a cool effect. It's unsettling. Everything else about the segment is horrible.
Yes. I would agree with you.
Should
there.
We go in order, or do you want to start with Ty West? Because here's the thing about the movie, I think. We have the wraparound segment, which is what's directed by Adam Wingard. It's called Tape 56.
And that bothered me for a number of reasons.
Okay.
Because And here you might argue, as we so often can argue with horror films, that my objection to the frame means that it worked.
Yes and no.
I hate those guys.
Yeah.
I hate what they represent.
Yeah.
I see them every day at school.
Yeah.
And I secretly want them to get it.
Right.
I want them to be punished.
Okay.
But I don't go to horror films to see horrible people get punished in malicious ways. That's not why I go to horror films.
Yeah.
And in a larger sense, let me just open up Pandora's box. My main objection to the film, and something that my wife had this very intense discussion about afterward, is that so many of the sequences are so utterly lacking in a moral center that I'm wondering if the filmmakers did it on purpose, and that what makes this a horror film is that I'm honestly scared of the world that it's presenting. There are very few sympathetic characters in this film.
Absolutely.
And most of the characters presented are awful.
Yeah, right off the bat, that you're the first characters you meet in the movie are these guys who have been hired to go get a tape out of a man's house.
And they're presented as vandals.
They're running around a parking lot, sexually assaulting women, and just doing horrible things. They're
because
the worst.
They have a contract with some porn website.
None of it makes very much sense,
I'm just
but
saying
whatever.
That
I agree with you. I tend to not like horror movies that are genuinely horrifying, and I guess that's
and the frame sequence reminded me very much of the sequence in Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Sure.
That really wigged me out the first time I saw the film, because like John Carpenter says in all those documentaries, if you cross the line, you lose the audience, mm-hmm. and you lose them badly. I was married with a kid and I owned a house and I went to see Henry and I was rejecting that sequence because it was too powerful. It was too effective. And that's what the frame story in VHS reminded me of. I don't want criminals to film their criminal activities and revel in them. Again, if the intent of the filmmakers is to shock me and horrify me with that, then they succeeded.
And maybe I'm not giving Adam Wingard enough credit here, but you bring up Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and the reason that why I think that movie works in the way that it works is because despite the fact that that sequence goes too far, the fact that it's genuinely upsetting and horrifying and disturbing, I always feel like John McNaughton knows what he's doing and that I'm in good hands, even though he's showing me horrible things and taking me places I don't want to go deliberately. I feel like he understands the material that he's presenting me and he understands what it is. And in VHS, and maybe it's because it comes so early, I don't know. I don't get that same sense.
It's very much like in the documentary The American Nightmare, mm-hmm. John Landis is interviewed. And he says, when you're watching the work of Hitchcock, you're in the hands of a master, and he knows how to manipulate you mm-hmm. very effectively, but safely. But in a lot of modern horror films, you feel like you're in the hands of a lunatic.
Right.
And not only is the frame story the most crudely filmed and in the most degraded video, but it's so close to a reality that I never want to confront. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm circling back to the opinion that if that was the intent of the filmmakers, then they win. They succeeded. It worked on me. It worked too well. But I found the frame story repellent.
Yeah. All right, let's move forward so that we can get into spoilers and stuff. But so the conceit of the movie is these guys have to find a videotape, so they keep going through these videos, and every time they put in a new one, we get a new little segment in the movie. So,
and again, in the frame story, I thought the reveal would be who sent them on this task and why this unnamed person needs this one specific tape. And that's never revealed.
No, the frame story doesn't work, as is so often the case in horror anthologies.
Although, can I bring this up?
Yeah.
And the insight is not mine, of course. It's my wife's, because she's smarter than me. The frame story ends.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the last videotape. I found that strange.
Yeah.
We don't go back to the frame. thump. And then the last tape, which my wife said, could this be the filmmakers indicating that we're one of the guys in the frame and we're the one person left alive in the house to witness the last tape? Could Maybe. You interpret it that way?
Maybe.
Because that interpretation makes me at least like that yeah. a lot more. That's intriguing.
Honestly, I feel like that approach was just correcting something that so many horror anthologies fall victim to. End with a bang, and then we got to go back and wrap up this stupid loose end, and you don't want to. You want to go out of the theater.
And I will give you this. The last sequence, which my wife and I have come to call Haunted House,
yeah.
it's almost as if working on a limited budget, they put all the money
yeah.
into that last sequence.
And all of these guys made their films independently of one another. And I know Ty West made his, I think, before anybody else. And then he saw everybody else's and thought, oh, if I knew what you guys were doing, I would have done something different.
Which is key here, because I'm amazed when you tell me this, because I don't know anything about the film going into it.
Yeah.
I know that you told me to watch it. That's all I know. I was amazed at how similar they were yeah. to each other.
Yeah. Which is crazy, right, because they all make them separately.
Although, again, my wife said, if the trope is this is found VHS footage, that sort of limits what you can do. Her example was, we're not going to get senior citizens picking apples. Senior citizens don't videotape themselves.
Playing kick young, the can.
Young people do.
Senior citizens play kick the can.
We'll get to kick the can.
After we get the introduction of the wraparound story, we get to Amateur Night, which is directed by David Bruckner, one of the guys who made The Signal, which is a movie that I like. Although it, too, is sort of an anthology of sorts, because it's three different stories. Part of one larger story made by three different filmmakers anyway. Amateur Night, for me, is the best in the movie.
I agree.
Again, it's a bunch of douchebags who decide to pick up some girls, one of whom is more than they bargained for. Don't watch the trailers if you plan on seeing this movie, because the trailer actually gives this away. And it's not like you don't see it coming, because, you know, we've all seen an episode of The Twilight Zone or read A Tales from the Crypt or whatever, but... I thought it was really effective.
As did I, and I gave the filmmakers behind Amateur Night a lot of credit for how cleverly they showed certain things and didn't show certain things. Mm-hmm. Because in terms of what's going on at the end of the sequence, mm-hmm. there's a very fine line between, mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, to your point about the first segment, this also presents some... horrible douchebags who are basically rapists, but it has its own morality.
Yeah.
It's a Tales from the Crypt morality, but...
I was giving the film a lot of credit, and I don't think this is a spoiler. One of the girls passes out.
Yes.
And the men do the right thing.
Right.
And don't take advantage of that.
Right.
Of course, in the moral universe of the film, this does not lead to...
It doesn't... help them.
It does not help them,
right.
But at least we don't have to witness that. I was watching the sequence, and it's the first sequence, and I really liked it a lot, and I was thinking, usually in these things, it will build,
right.
And I thought, but then I remembered that you also want to start
right.
in a certain way,
right.
And it was a very calculated decision to start with that one.
Yes, and the problem is that it doesn't get better after that, and I think
no.
I said that when I talked about it before. And they come close, because I think Haunted House is the half that it, when I said I like one and a half, Haunted House is the half.
Okay.
So, they were smart in terms of where they placed them. They tried to, you know, bookend with good and good.
Yeah.
But Haunted House doesn't totally work.
But then, that only serves to remind me of Creepshow.
Right.
Where they're all pretty good.
Except for Jordy, Lonesome Death of Jordy, what's his name?
Now, see, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
I consider The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill to be a palate cleanser about halfway through.
Perhaps.
And I felt exactly the same way about the noir one.
Okay. Okay.
Because at least that one's a little different.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So we're going to go into that, and then we'll start to spoil, and we can be more specific about
okay.
things. Next is Second Honeymoon, Ty West.
I call that one the noir one.
Yeah. About a couple filming themselves on a second honeymoon, and someone is watching them, basically, while they sleep.
And I'm trying to decide if this is a spoiler or not. Are we there yet?
To the second honeymoon?
No. Usually you don't spoil things till halfway through.
Well, we're almost there. I want to get through each segment quickly.
And okay. I don't think this is spoiling anything. Second honeymoon contains the trope of someone filming you when you're sleeping.
Like Lost Highway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's...
scary.
That's very scary.
Yeah. And Second Honeymoon sort of explains that, but I have a lot of problems with Second Honeymoon. But okay.
It's like a bad Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah.
Although I will admit...
and it feels really rushed.
That the reveal at the end...
yeah.
...clears up some things from earlier... where, because Amateur Night was first, and you're expecting Supernatural, you sort of have a question about some things in Second Honeymoon.
Sure.
And the reveal, the twist, hardly a twist, but the twist explains it nicely.
Absolutely. Next is Tuesday the 17th, which I think is the worst segment in the movie, and we sort of talked about that. Kids go into the woods. It turns out a girl is trying to track down a murderer that she had a run-in with years earlier.
She's actually tracking down... oh, that would be a spoiler. Oh, shut up.
Yeah.
It's a funny joke, though.
It was... that, to me, is definitely the low point in the movie. And again, I haven't seen... I think this was the only one where I had not seen this director's... any of this director's previous work, so I have nothing to compare it to. I haven't seen I Sell the Dead, so I can't say, I don't understand how that guy made this. Then we go into The Sick Thing That Happened to Emily When She Was Younger, directed by Joe Swanberg, mumblecore filmmaker du jour, who makes four movies a year. Interestingly enough, Joe Swanberg plays the man, the couple in Second Honeymoon.
Oh.
He's the man half.
Because the one that we're talking about now is the Skype one.
The Skype one, correct.
And I thought it was an interesting idea... badly handled.
Yes, absolutely. And then we'll talk more about that. But yeah, he's in Second Honeymoon. He's the man in the couple.
I thought you were going to say he was the little...
no,
he was that would be little, a spoiler. He was a little Skype face.
Then we go to 10/31/98, which we have referred to as Haunted House.
Yeah.
Directed by a group of people, a collective, who call themselves Radio Silence. I thought there was some things in 10/31/98, which I'm just going to keep calling Haunted House because it's so much easier.
My titles for these. The noir one.
Okay. Is that Second Honeymoon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Haunted House are much better than their titles for these.
There's things in Haunted House that I like a lot. And then there's some things I don't like. But it does present... I think there are... two sympathetic characters in the movie. And I'm going to call the group of guys in Haunted House one sympathetic character in the movie.
Yes.
The other one is the girl in...
Skype.
No. Not even... I guess she would be. I thought the girl in Amateur Night, actually, was a sympathetic character. And I won't say more.
Not the girl who passes out.
No, the other one.
Oh, no. I agree completely.
Okay. Anyway...
that is one image from Amateur Night I will never be able to shake from my subconscious. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
I think so. But I was creeped out. Well, we'll get into it. So those are the pieces in VHS. And it sounds like you have sort of had the exact same reaction, that this one's great, this one's okay, the rest are degrees of... ugh.
And I swear I didn't sit there like a stern moralizer and look at the entire film as a stringent moral tale. But the minute I finished watching it, I tried to put my finger on what was bothering me about it. And part of it was that it began with bros with cameras. And it was bothering me. Yeah. So when we actually went to the sequences within, I liked it a lot better. But the more I started looking at it as, does this film have a moral center? Or is one of the ways it's trying to frighten us is by suggesting that the world is chaos. There's no order. There's no rules. There's no reward. You exist to be killed. Then that's another kind of film. It's a film that I really don't like as well, because I know that life is meaningless. That's why I go to movies.
Let's talk spoilers now for VHS. If you haven't seen it, again, I think it's worth seeing. Because it tries to do some interesting things, and it presents a few new, perhaps upcoming voices in horror.
If you haven't seen it, shut the podcast off.
Yeah.
Listen to Patrick. Patrick thinks you should see it. I don't think you should see it. Patrick could take me in a fair fight. So shut the podcast off and watch it now. And then you'll come back to the podcast and say, I have a newfound respect for JB's opinions.
I'm not even arguing that it's entirely successful. I just think it's a movie that's worth seeing. I think there are a few horror movies that
come out. I'm not sure if I would agree with that.
No, that's totally fine. But I think there are very few horror movies that come out now. And so many of them that do, we joked about a few weeks ago, which is just girl, supernatural thing.
No, I just got to say this. I am savoring this. I am treasuring this because so many of our podcasts are Chris Farley shows.
Yeah.
We seldom disagree.
That's true. So, I don't even think we disagree. I think we just are disagreeing on see it or don't, because I think our feelings about the movie are very similar. I just think it's worth seeing, flawed as it is.
Yes. You said they made the sequences independently.
Yes. We're in spoilers now, everybody.
Right. One of the few things they should have done was to have a powwow and say, what kinds of VHS-y things are you going to do?
Yeah.
Because that gets...
Well, and part of the problem with found footage, period, is that you always have to establish, why does this tape exist? Yes. Why is this person filming this? And now you get to VHS, which has five or six different... Why are we... Over and over, we have to establish, why are we filming this? And Joe Swanberg's piece is kind of clever. It's this video chat between a couple. However, it makes no sense that it ends up on a VHS tape.
I actually like that Haunted House solved the problem in the silliest way, but in a way it was the best. The guy dressed as a bear for Halloween put a nanny cam in the bear head. Right. Got it? Let's go.
Well, and Amateur Night does something similar with glasses cam. And, again, it's sort of laborious the way they have to explain, try on glasses cam or whatever.
Oh, my God.
Right.
They spend so much time on that at the beginning.
But I will say, okay, but then that gets rid of, like, hey, why wouldn't you put the camera down at some point? Like, okay, now we at least understand. One of the things I like about Amateur Night, and it's hard, I was really not liking the movie for a little while because we spend 10 minutes with bros raping women in the parking garage. Then we go right into Amateur Night, which is more bros out to rape more women. And I was like, Jesus. At one point, I think I didn't even realize that we were in a new segment. I was like, is this the same guys? Because they're acting so similarly. But one of the things I liked about Amateur Night was its pacing. It does take way too long at the beginning, but that's because it's going to pay off.
Yeah.
And Second Honeymoon could have stood to be a lot longer because it feels very rushed.
And arguably, though, Second Honeymoon has the most realistic explanation. We're on a vacation
filming ourselves, and
we're filming.
Right, absolutely. So now I don't... Where do you want to start in terms of spoilers? Do you want to talk about, like, your reaction to the movie, the conversation that you had afterwards?
That I was... I would like the film to have a moral center.
Yes.
Which sort of surprised my wife, because I revel in horror films, and right now we're surrounded by all these totems of horror films where people get ripped apart in a violent way. But I was arguing that, and maybe this comes down to very fine distinctions of aesthetics, that there's a way to artistically justify ripping someone apart, and there's a way to waste your time on the work of morons with cameras.
Okay.
The fact that almost every character in VHS is just morally reprehensible, I had a problem with.
Yeah.
One of the more sympathetic characters is a victim in the Skype sequence.
Yes.
And I gave the gentlemen, the four gentlemen who are going to this Halloween party in the final segment, I gave them so much credit because at the end of the film, they're faced with a moral dilemma, and they make the decision to risk their own lives to save someone.
Yeah.
And for this effort, they are killed.
Right.
In a pretty awful way. I mean, if I made a list of the ways I wouldn't want to go.
Getting hit by a train? Stuck in a car?
Although, in terms of the trope of found footage, and in terms of the camera's in the car, and the car won't move, and you can't get out of the car, that's very frightening.
Absolutely. What I didn't like about that, I thought the run through, well, now we're going to be all out of order, but whatever. The run through the haunted house, I thought was really effective. The arms coming out of the walls. I thought all that stuff really worked. I thought the whole train thing was such a limp noodle of a finale. And I wasn't even as bothered by it as you were in terms of the morality that, oh, we still have to kill these guys. And I do have that problem a lot in horror movies. We know I hate that remake of Dawn of the Dead because it's like, they got away. Let's let them get away, everyone. No, no. More zombies? Okay. Go fuck yourselves. So, and I wasn't even objecting to that. I was so bothered by how just lazy it felt. Like, oh, and then they're stuck on that train, and then they get hit by a train. Because one of the things you also have in VHS, and I don't know that this is true in every horror anthology, but probably most of them, they all have to have a twist, right?
Yeah.
And that the twist of Haunted House was that she really is possessed, and they did the wrong thing by saving her. And I thought that was kind of interesting, that the guys that they saw up in the room that they thought were torturing this innocent girl were trying to exorcise a demon.
Yes.
And were sort of doing the right thing in
the reality of the film.
Right, right. So I didn't mind that twist. Again, it's a twist you could probably see coming. And then I just thought the train thing was so lazy and such a weak way to end the movie coming off of, I thought, the cool exit through the haunted house.
Yeah, and clearly that sequence had the biggest budget because some of those effects were very, very wonderful to look at. But again, getting back to Moral Center, I immediately started to compare VHS to Creepshow, and maybe that was the wrong film to compare it to, because Creepshow is based on comic books from the 50s that were very stringent moral tales.
Yes.
And maybe this is just me as grandpa not being able to adapt to the modern world, but it was the same thing that bothered me about Bros with Cameras at the beginning that bothered me about the slippery morality of the rest of the film,
mm-hmm.
that these filmmakers, it seems in some of the sequences, are setting people up to be knocked down, and that's a shooting gallery, that's not a film.
But there's another thing that I think the movie is doing that I think, again, all of these filmmakers, save for one perhaps, are concerned with, and it's interesting that it was all independently of one another, but I think that the movie has some interesting things to say about gender, not just in horror films. But if you think about it, each one of them comes down to this idea of men subjugating women.
Yes.
And the price that they pay for doing that. Not always. I mean, the guy in Skype doesn't pay a price, but there's definitely something very disturbing going on
with what he's doing. At the core of that story, the most disturbing thing is what he's doing.
Right.
And actually, you saying that makes me like the film more, mm-hmm. because at least it's trying to explore something.
Right.
But I think how repellent that is to me,
sure,
is a reason why I'm rejecting it.
Ty West, I think, does it not the most explicitly, because Swanberg does it more explicitly because that's what his whole thing is about. But Ty West is about flipping that, the traditional sort of slasher movie, horror movie archetypes on their heads, that the reveal is that the man is the murder victim at the hands of two women who have been having an affair.
But there's two very interesting things that happen in that sequence.
Yeah.
If you want to go down this road of voyeurism and male subjugation, that at one point he wants to film he and his wife having sex.
Right.
And it's a really creepy, uncomfortable sequence because she ultimately rejects him. I thought that made him very unsympathetic.
Sure.
Not that I want to see him get killed. But the thing I found more interesting is, and this is the sequence where they're being filmed while they're asleep, her lover gets into the hotel room. Now that I know it's her lover, I can understand how she could get into a locked room, because before that I thought it was something supernatural.
Right.
How can someone get into a locked room?
Right.
So the lover is videotaping them and is shown stealing money from his wallet. Later, his reaction to that...
He blames the wife.
And she says, I didn't do it.
Right.
And he says, this wouldn't be the first time you've treated yourself.
Right.
What does that mean?
My understanding was that he is aware of an affair that she has had in the past, most likely with a woman. And that that's part of why they're on this second honeymoon. And that was one of the things that I liked about the segment, was that there are offhand lines of dialogue that suggest that these people have a life outside of this 10 minutes that we spend with them.
Let me share with you my radical remake of film noir. What's the real... Second Honeymoon.
Second Honeymoon.
They go to a Wild West town, and they put money into one of those booths with the mechanical fortune teller.
Okay.
And as befits the stylization of this old Western time, it's an old miner. And the old miner gives them some advice, and then a little card pops out. And then nothing is done with that. Because later, when they're in the hotel room, and there's a knock at the door, I turn to my family and I said, it's the old miner. I honestly thought that's where the film was going to go.
Okay. Again, I think it presents some ideas. I think Ty West has something that he wants to accomplish. I don't think it's successful because I think the pacing is wrong. I think the payoff is a little bit weak. I don't think it works just dramatically.
Good last line, though.
What's the last line? I don't remember.
You erased it, right?
Oh, yeah. And that comes up again, I think, in the Joe Swanberg thing, where he's got some interesting ideas that there's this weird Skype chat, and the moment where the girl is unconscious, it logistically makes no sense, and the guy comes out of the room next door, right?
Yeah.
That he's in the apartment basically with her all the time. I mean, again, logistically makes no sense. Wouldn't she just hear his voice in the next room? But she thinks she's talking to him very far away. I thought that, I perked up for a minute there, and then it turns into this weird aliens harvesting organs, or I don't know if they're aliens, little weird things harvesting organs, and they have to do it over and over again, and then at the end the punchline is he's doing it to a new girl.
And the assumption is there's several of these.
Right.
It seems as if the ending of that wasn't quite worked out.
Yeah, yeah. But again, an interesting premise. And tries to do something a little bit different with the found footage aesthetic by turning it into this Skype chat.
Once you see the twist, though, and again, my wife pointed this out, and the more I think about it, the more delicious I think it is, that near the end, she says, I don't know why you put up with me. And he says, but I'm in love with you. It's not as if I have a choice. And once you finish the sequence, that line is pretty well written.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, you know, this guy's awful. What he's doing is awful, and it's interesting that it's directed by the same guy who played sort of the awful man in the second honeymoon sequence. I don't know. Let's talk about Amateur Night real quick. We'll go back to the beginning, because again, I think that one's the most successful, and I don't think it's just because that's the one that it's really the only one that has a monster.
The actress that they got to play her.
Yes.
Early on in the bar.
Yeah.
I like you. Isn't that what she says?
I think so. I swear there's a few times, and maybe it's because I was watching this late at night. And
oh, no. It's very hard to hear.
Just that was scaring me, honestly. Like, I was already a little bit freaked out by the fact that she's talking, but I don't hear what she's saying, and something is clearly off. And again, you know where it's going, basically, that yeah. These guys are going to be punished for this, probably by this girl. But I think the way that it's done is pretty satisfying. I think the effect really, is cool.
And what really elevates the sequence, major spoilers, is it turns out she does really like one of them.
Yeah.
He tries to get away. He breaks something,
which
falling down the steps.
Yeah.
It's hard to look at.
Yeah. But again, that's very impressive that that's all, you know, theoretically done in one take, the fall down the steps to the broken bone.
And he is set upon by this girl, who is now a monster, and we think that she's going into feed, but she's not. I really like you. And you realize, I've never seen this in a movie before. And his inability to participate in this act with her understandably, considering the circumstances, is what seals his doom. The sequence at the end where she takes him.
Yeah, you don't know that, you don't realize she can fly, and then all of a sudden she's picked him up.
I thought that was something.
Yeah, I thought that whole segment worked. And again, you kind of perk up and you think like, oh, maybe, you know, this movie's going to be something. And then every subsequent sequence is an exercise in frustration and disappointment.
Was it just the nature of found footage trope? Or is it just interesting that they all arrive there in their different ways? The view of men in this film is really atrocious.
Yeah.
Did they set out to do that?
I don't know that they all sat down and set out to do that. I think what you have is a group of filmmakers who are working in the horror genre who
are soulless.
No. I think, honestly, that they're a little bit smarter than
the average bear?
Than the guys who are making some of these other horror movies.
There is a bear in the film at the end.
That is just a... There are so many horror movies now, sort of in the wake of Saw, and I hate to, you know, just point to that movie as being the downfall of horror, but the movie's a hit, people begin to imitate it, and now you have a decade's worth of horror movies that are just about nihilism and violence and how much punishment can the human body take. And so many of those movies have nothing to say. And so I think you have a group of guys who are a little bit more thoughtful. A lot of them are sort of independent, you know, come from the indie background, who are a little bit more thoughtful than that and who sit down and I think just say, okay, I'm going to make this little horror movie, and aren't necessarily content to just do a little genre exercise, and that they want to say, okay, well, what is horrifying to me? And one of the things, one of the conclusions that they arrive at is, me. I'm, you know, men. We are sort of horrifying, the things that we are capable of the way that we are capable of treating women.
If that was premeditated, I give the film more credit.
I'm putting words in their mouth.
I think I'm starting to give the film more credit just because I'm sitting here talking to you about it. And I'm getting something out of our conversation, so I don't think it was 2 hours wasted.
Sure. Which is why I thought the movie is worth seeing, even if it doesn't all work. I don't think it's 2 hours wasted. That would have been a better way of saying it.
When I was done watching it, it made me want to take a shower.
Yeah.
And in fact, I did. Right after I finished watching it, I took a shower. So I would be springtime fresh for your arrival
at
my house.
Thank you. The two worst segments in the movie, I think, are the wraparound, which goes nowhere and contributes nothing to the movie because all that's revealed... There's a dead guy in the apartment while they're watching tapes. At one point, I guess, the dead guy wakes up and kills people?
I assume the guy on the steps was him because at one point the chair's empty. And when you watch one of these tapes, this is a big problem with the wraparound. Do you disappear?
Because each time it's a new guy, right?
They come back in the room.
Right.
Where's Joe?
Right.
Or whatever.
And we do that over and over again. And there's no payoff. So really, the wraparound segment's only significant contribution to the movie, aside from establishing the architecture, is that 10 minutes at the beginning that's just awfulness for the sake of being awful.
Yeah. And
so
is that supposed to be the attention getter?
I don't know.
Because that almost made me shut it off.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really bad. And then the other worst segment, I don't think I'm being controversial when I say, is that Tuesday the 17th.
Yeah.
Which I tries to sort of just do a slasher movie in the span of 11 minutes and is terrible. And aside from just the fact that it has, you know, the worst acting and writing in the movie, makes no sense in that this girl has tricked all her friends in coming back to confront the murderer.
And apparently has set some very elaborate traps.
And for this is just murdered herself.
Where, again, this is JB's radical remake of the film. When that sequence started, I thought the filmmakers were going to use the trope that bad events leave some sort of karmic residue.
Yeah.
And that the video camera was capable of showing them what once happened there.
Okay.
And I thought that's where it was going. But
okay.
That's not where it goes at all.
And I thought that the camera's inability to photograph the killer, because he's just this weird tracking effect. And again, I thought it, visually it's effective.
Yeah.
I wish it had been used in a better movie. That I thought that that was some weird commentary on our inability to get a handle on the past completely. That it's there, but it's blurry and out of focus. But again, we're ascribing greater meaning to something which is just this idiotic slasher movie.
I will give the film one compliment. There's some sequences, there are certain sequences where sound is used very effectively,
okay.
I thought.
Unfortunately, again, I watched it very late at night with the sound turned down very low, and I probably did not make best advantage of that.
I had it on very loud going through the sound bar,
yeah.
And I think the sound of the tracking killer, but there's another sequence where there's this very loud, low rumble.
Okay.
And I can't remember what sequence it was.
I would guess it was Haunted House, but that's just a guess.
It was very well done. It was very unnerving.
I think overall, I don't like the found footage aesthetic. I don't like the shaky cam, but I do think that there's something about the remove of VHS, and again, I tried to talk about this before, that makes everything inherently scarier, because all of a sudden it's real. If we're watching just a movie, we suspend our disbelief. This is a movie. This is shot on a set, blah, blah, blah. But as soon as you add this weird VHS element...
Yes. And that brought me back to the film's worldview.
Right.
Because in trying to portray it as if it really happened, it's showing me a world that I don't want to spend 2 hours in.
Sure.
Because I spend 24 hours a day in that world.
Right. Right. Real quick, and then we're going to wrap up. We had originally planned to talk about VHS for a little while, and then we're going to talk about horror anthologies.
But VHS was so profound.
It turns out that we had more to say about VHS than we thought.
No, we can dispense with this very quickly.
Well, it's a horror anthology. They try them every couple of years. Oddly enough, last year, a movie came out called Chillerama that kind of tried to do the same thing. It presents three sort of up-and-coming horror filmmakers.
Which you've seen, but I haven't yet.
It was available on Netflix Instant. I do not believe it is anymore. It's awful. I think VHS is a better movie. While Chillerama is sort of more in the spirit of Creepshow, it's certainly
more jokey.
Yeah, definitely. It's more fun. But VHS, I think, is a better movie. But let me just throw out to you, just name a couple of your favorite horror anthologies.
And that's easy, because it's very hard to get it right.
Yeah.
I've talked about this before on the podcast. It's called Dead of Night. It was made in the 40s. Here, you see one of the things that VHS could have benefited from. The sequences are all really different.
Right.
Some of them are long, some of them are short, some of them are tongue-in-cheek. One of them is one of the scariest things I've ever seen. So it benefits from that. Don't Be Afraid. It's only available on DVD as a double feature with another film from that era.
What is?
Dead of Night.
Oh, yeah.
I forget what the second feature is. Yeah, I bought it for Dead of Night.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is a very famous film. Can't it sell itself?
Yeah, I got it from a library, I think.
Every time I see Creepshow, I love it more than I did when it first came out.
Yeah, Creepshow for me is my favorite, I think.
And this sounds like such a cliche, in every frame, the love that King and Romero had. I mean, talk about the gateway drug for these comic books.
Yeah.
That back in the 50s, no kid should have been reading those, just this guilty pleasure.
Do you think Creepshow at all benefits from sort of that singularity of voice, where VHS, we have all these different guys being smashed together into one movie, whereas Creepshow, it's King and Romero in every story.
But consider this. I think they were smart enough to realize that the original EC comic books, which is what they're portraying, had sort of four or five basic stories, and they effectively present every one of them.
Yeah.
Although I've always thought it was strange, there were some EC stories that went way overboard in terms of gore, and they really sort of shied away from that.
Yeah, it's not a very gory movie. The showstopper is the last couple minutes.
Yeah. I would say half of Twilight Zone is magnificent and works.
George Miller and Joe Dante.
Right. Obviously, the first sequence was compromised because of the well-known horrible tragedy that occurred. And Steven Spielberg's segment is just...
Oh, my gosh.
It's the filmic equivalent of unsweetened oatmeal. It's just it's bathos.
Yeah.
The Dante sequence, I think, is one of the most successful things he's ever done about his obsessions.
Yeah.
And even more interestingly, considering that he did the second Looney Tunes film, the whole concept that this childish comic cartoon world, those original Looney Tunes, when Bugs Bunny was still psychotic, how frightening that can be.
Yeah.
And just the art direction and the prop design is just, and talk about a film that benefits from being made before CGI, that damn rabbit is a physical thing.
When I was a kid, the girl with no mouth was one of the scariest things I'd seen.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And then you get Miller's sequence, which is a tour de force, and I know the original Twilight Zone episode is famous, but Miller bests it. And there was a time when I would show just that sequence in class, and we would still frame it. And there's a whole bunch of subliminal stuff.
Really?
In the Miller sequence. If you can get the DVD and you've got some patience, check it out. It's really amazing. At one point, they have a very elaborate prosthetic effect on Lithgow's eyes. And it's very fast. You have to still frame it. They inflate his eyes.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's raining and there's lightning and stuff and the camera's tracking in and it's maybe three frames, but my students and I were like, wait a minute. And oh my God.
And again, the great story about Twilight Zone, the movie, is Spielberg and Landis were the superstars and Dante and Miller were sort of the upstarts, the guys that nobody was familiar with, and they steal the movie.
But I think everyone concerned, unless it was originally designed this way, there's a reason why Dante and Miller sequences are at the end.
I mean, the movie's paced.
If you put Kick the Can third, it's deadly. Recently, we had occasion to see this film with the Portage, and the filmmaker was there, and that was the first time I'd ever seen it. Trick or Treat grows in my estimation every time I see it, if only for how transgressive it is, but in the opposite way of VHS.
Okay.
I think that film earns its transgressive material.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
That film does have a moral center. As twisted as it might be.
Yeah, right. The moral center has to do with not the morality that we recognize, but sort of these unspoken rules of Halloween.
Yeah.
You have to respect, and I think the filmmaker even said as much, that the little guy, the little boy Jack, I think he's called, that he's there. He's the Halloween police, basically. And you have to respect the rules of Halloween or bad things happen to you. And that movie very quickly went on everybody's list of the best horror anthologies.
And think about this, because we've just been discussing how difficult it is to navigate. The frame story in that works wonderfully.
Sure.
And the whole idea of all of this is happening on the same Halloween night is much more elegant than the way some other horror anthologies.
Definitely.
And this is a personal choice, and you can argue that it's not 100% of greatness, but it's called Trilogy of Terror.
Ooh, made for TV, right?
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
And I love it. I love it. And I would even argue that the first two sequences are boring on purpose.
Interesting.
The first two sequences are standard, mid-range Twilight Zone episodes. The twists aren't all that exciting. I think that's part of the strategy. Because when that first
aired... Does that little dude come last?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, are you kidding? When that first aired, nobody was prepared for how relentless that last sequence is. And I'm sorry. I think I was 10. I think that was probably the scariest thing I'd ever seen. The noise it makes.
I've never seen it. I'm familiar with the little guy, because you just are growing up knowing horror movies.
Karen Black buys this little Zuni doll. And of course she's told never to take the metal off from around its neck. But we know what happens. Robert Block wrote all three sequences. And I could be completely wrong. I think he did it on purpose. It's just the greatest fake out.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what this is going to be. No, you don't.
Last year for Scary Movie Month, I watched a lot of movies. And there were a bunch of anthologies on Netflix Instant. Most made in sort of the 80s, a few maybe in the early 90s, and almost all of them were just utter garbage. And every once in a while, you'll find an anthology with with one story that jumps out that kind of works. I mean, Creepshow 2 gets a pass.
We had a recent conversation on this, on the comment section, because the problem with Creepshow 2 is there's no quality control.
Right. But the middle segment, it's called The Raft, based on a story that appeared in Skeleton Crew, pretty much works. I don't even think it's as great as some people say, but...
And I have affection for the Hitch.
Really?
Because it's so goofy.
Thanks for the ride, lady.
Yeah, I mean...
That first segment is death, though. That wooden Indian with George Kennedy.
Oh, it's the worst thing ever. But... That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I think you should have said it 10 more times.
I'm a fan of Black Sunday, the Mario Bava movie from the 60s. And also, I think, kind of an underrated horror anthology that came out in the mid-90s. The 90s were a terrible time for horror. But a movie called Tales from the Hood came out. And it was sort of the blaxploitation answer to horror anthologies. And each one has a different sort of thing to say about race or the black experience in the 90s. And it feels like goofy schlock, because it sort of is, and it's very much in that EC Comics tradition. But I think it's well worth people's time.
I've never seen it.
It got written off, because it has Hood, and it's combining sort of blaxploitation and horror at a time when people could care less about either of those things. It has Hood in the title, and...
I think I'm confusing it with Tales from the Crypt Presents Bordello of Blood.
Perhaps, which, man, I was there opening night for that, because I just thought, Dennis Miller is the hero, and Angie Everhart is a vampire, and Corey Feldman figures into this. I mean, I just thought it was like this great collision of all these kitschy things, and it was...
It's horrible,
it's
right?
Garbage, okay. Yeah. No. And I'm kind of a fan of Demon Knight, the first movie produced under the Tales from the Crypt banner. I think Demon Knight kind of works. Demon Knight, I believe I have this right. Ernest Dickerson did Demon Knight and Tales from the Hood. So there you go. There's the connection.
I like him.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Maybe you'll check out VHS. I don't know.
And continue to post scary movie reviews.
Yeah.
And if you live in the Chicagoland area, consider attending The Massacre October 20th at the Portage Theater.
Stay tuned for our podcast on that. If you're not able to make it, we will talk to you guys soon.